This is an ABC podcast.
Elvis Presley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan. Friends, we'd like to do a number for you from our new album.
On ABC Radio, Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
Well, the bless of my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Well, John Lennon once said, before Elvis, there was nothing. So where do you start with Elvis and the influence that he's had? Watching the Elvis midday movie with my nana was one of my all-time favourite things to do. But growing up, Elvis was everywhere. And the thing is, he still is. Well, he's the king. He's the founder of rock and roll. But he's also had a huge influence on the world of fashion and countless other areas of popular culture. And if you're an Elvis fan, then get ready, because from this Saturday, some incredible artifacts from Elvis's life, direct from Graceland, are on exhibition at the Bendigo Art Gallery. Fiona Parker, breakfast presenter of ABC Central Victoria, based in Bendigo, and your co-host today. Fee, this is an exciting time, not just for Elvis fans, but for the city of Bendigo.
Absolutely. Bendigo can't help falling in love with Elvis, Rochelle.
How many times can we do that?
Came from. We're all shook up, et cetera, et cetera. But look, it has been so interesting for me since I knew this exhibition was coming to do some research over the last few months into who Elvis Presley actually was, because I know I'm not alone in that my knowledge of him was pretty superficial. Like, I knew the songs, I knew 50s Elvis shaking his hips on the Ed Sullivan Show. I knew the Hollywood movies like Blue Hawaii, and then of course the 70s Elvis, which is one of the more enduring sort of images we have of him, the rhinestone jumpsuits, sideburns Elvis, the high collars, that sort of thing. But there's so much more to him, to his life, his career, what he actually wanted to do as opposed to what he was contractually obliged to do, and the directions he was pushed in, particularly with his acting career, his musical influences as well, because let's not forget, as you pointed out, you know, before Elvis there was nothing. Rock and roll music didn't exist before Elvis came along. He managed to mesh together existing genres like blues and country and western to create this new sound. And then, of course, he has influenced the course of music and so many artists right up to today. So I'm really looking forward to talking about all of that over the next hour or so.
Then there's fashion as well. And I sort of, being someone that loves fashion myself, just looking at what he did and not having a lot of money and really standing out on his own, and the sort of clothes that he wore and the way that he wore them, his hair goes without saying. And that is still something that's influencing fashion designers and those that just want an individual look now as well. But part of today we'll be looking at how else did he influence popular culture. But I'm with you, Fiona. I've started to only discover a little bit about who he was as a person and how he came to be what he was, the influences that other people had on him as well. And I'll also be intrigued to discover today whether or not the next generation will know and love and be as influenced by Elvis as previous generations. You know, do you need that person in your life, a parent, a grandparent, a brother or a sister or someone, to really give you that Elvis passion?
Like perhaps we had in our lives, or we know someone who's into classic cars, for example, who's part of that rockabilly scene, and they introduce you to Elvis, that sort of thing. Will it filter down to decades and decades on? I think our next guest might suggest it would.
Absolutely, absolutely. Plenty of guests for you today as well, but we want to hear from you. How much of an influence did Elvis have on you? Does he still? And will the next generations still see him as the king?
Let's go on a moonlight swim, far away from the crowd, all alone upon the beach. Our lips and arms close within each other's reach will be.
This is The Conversation Hour.
Many artefacts direct from Graceland coming to Bendigo from this weekend. There's an incredible quote here, Fiona Parker. It says, "Graceland is a powerful gateway into Elvis's life, but it's also a place to unlock and unravel your own relationship with your personal memories of his music, art and performance. So many of us found Elvis in our childhood, and as you walk through the house and you see the physical manifestation of all of the things he loved, you can't help but reflect on your own life and fantasize about what you would have loved to have had in your house if you were Elvis. For many of us, childhood memories can be prickly, but while you're in Graceland, bathed in its celebratory decor, your reflections are filtered and funneled through innocence and joyfulness." And that's from Henry Waggons, who we'll hear a little bit from later on, but he's also a big part of the exhibition in Bendigo as well.
That's right, and he's been to Graceland a few times, of course, Elvis's beloved home, which is where our next guest actually works. How lucky is Angie Marchese? She's Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at Elvis Presley Enterprises, Graceland, that place that has become a beacon for Elvis and pop culture fans. She is in our Bendigo studios here at ABC Local Radio. Angie Marchese, welcome to the ABC and welcome to Bendigo.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I'm even more excited to talk about Elvis and about the exhibit.
That's right. You're Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at Elvis Presley Enterprises. What do you actually do?
Well, I maintain and take care of the collection, which includes over 1.5 million items. That's everything from photography to documents to wardrobe to cars to an airplane to the mansion itself. I basically get paid to play with Elvis's stuff all day and make it tell stories. That's what I do.
That is the most incredible job. I was reading that there's something like 90,000 photographs, furniture, instruments. As you said, there's cars as well. How do you actually physically go about maintaining and checking on all of these things? You know, we all go up to the attic or go out into the shed into something that we think we've been preserved for a while, only to find that possums have got in there or mice or something's got a bit damp. How do you go about preserving all of these incredible pieces?
Well, we have a very detailed conservation plan in place. Most of the collection is actually stored in a climate-controlled building, which stays at 68 degrees all year long. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but 68 degrees Fahrenheit and around 48% humidity. So it's kind of the perfect climate for anything, wardrobe, documents, photography. Film likes to be a little bit colder, but because we have such a multi-mix of medium in the building, we keep it at that level. And we have a digital database where everything is cataloged and inventoried into, so I can physically pull up every photo we have of Elvis looking to the left, smiling, holding a microphone if I wanted to. And so there was a lot of work has gone into doing this. I started in the archives department literally cataloging photos back in 1995. And that was just one part of the collection. And so it's great to see how the collection has grown, but it also is amazing how we're able to use the collection to engage our guests and to engage the experience to actually give people an insight into who Elvis was.
Absolutely. So when and how did you actually get that gig?
I'm one of the most fortunate people. I actually started as a tour guide when I was 17.
A tour guide at Graceland?
At Graceland. It was a summer job. My guidance counselor at school said, "Hey, I think you'd be a good tour guide. You have a great personality." And I'm like, "Oh, that sounds like fun." And like you were saying, I knew who Elvis was. My mom was a huge Elvis fan. So I would watch his movies on Saturday afternoons. They used to come on TV and I could name a few songs. And of course, 70s Jumpsuit Elvis was the one I most connected with because that's what I saw. And so I thought, you know, I'm not from Memphis originally. I'm from Florida. And I had moved to Memphis when I was 15. And so it was kind of like, well, if I lived in Florida still, I'd go work at Disney World. So I'm living in Memphis. Let's go work at Graceland. I mean, so it was so much fun. And I like to say my summers never ended because we always used to joke that when we go out and get real jobs and...
You're still at Graceland.
33
I love
years.
Those stories. I love those. It gives us all hope, really, doesn't it? Angie Marchese is with you. She's the Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at Elvis Presley Enterprises. Of course, many of those pieces are coming to the Bendigo Art Gallery. It is open to the general public from this Saturday. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, good morning. I had the pleasure, I guess, of visiting the place where Elvis was born, the house in Tupelo, Mississippi. And, yeah, his was abject poverty, and he was on the wrong side of town. And I always think of Elvis as somebody who grew up in Mississippi in terrible times.
Yeah.
But when you see him, he's always smiling with black folk. He's got no issues, even though where he's from, everybody was racial.
Are you a big Elvis fan?
No, I believe Chuck Berry was way more significant in popular music, albeit Elvis is enormous. But I just happened to be on a rock and roll tour there that I sort of guided myself and my colleague through. And if you're in that part of the world and you're going to go to Memphis, you may as well go to Tupelo as well.
And see his humble beginnings. Perhaps, Angie, you can talk a little bit more on that for people that don't know the story.
So Elvis was actually, as mentioned, born in Tupelo, Mississippi, which is about 90 miles south of Memphis. And he was kind of on the wrong side of the tracks. He grew up in great poverty. He didn't have a lot. His was born in a house that his dad and his uncle built for $180 that they then lost because they couldn't keep up the $5 a month payments on it. So he was very much the underclass, as you could say. And in search for a better life, his dad was the one that moved the family to Memphis when he was 13. And again, being part of public housing and still being not on the, you know, above, living above the poverty line, you know, Elvis really knew what hard work was. He knew who the backbone of society was. And he was, because he was part of that. He grew up with that culture, you know. He was very friendly with the African-American artist. He absorbed everything that they had. He had a great appreciation for them because of their authenticity. That was the one thing about Elvis that he always connected with, was somebody who was authentic and was true to themselves and who they were as a person. And he felt that with the blues music that they would play in Shake Rag and Tupelo or on Beale Street. Those were some of his early influences. And obviously, he gives them much credit. And I know the gentleman mentioned Chuck Berry, and him and Chuck Berry both were actually great friends. Everyone says Elvis created rock and roll, but there was a rock and roll movement happening. Elvis just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And he was able to open the doors for all of these artists that doors would never have been opened for.
It's incredible, Angie, that everybody that loves Elvis has a great story to tell and has one of those 6 degrees of separation of Elvis. We want to hear some of those today as well. 1-300-222-774. But in the couple of minutes of coming into the studio here today, the two people that I spoke to about Elvis both had great stories. One was a gentleman waiting to go on to Virginia Trioli's show, and he said, "Oh, I've just come back from Parks, where I stayed at the Memphis Hotel." Of course, Parks is where they, in New South Wales, where they had the huge Elvis events, and all of the Elvis impersonators sort of flock there at multiple times of the year. But, you know, he was talking about staying in the Elvis Hotel. And, of course, Ross Kay, who many people know here as one of our producers and of Sammy J, he had the privilege, right, of driving the guy around that said this.
Elvis has left the building.
Now, what I love about this, so Ross drove him, picked him up from his home and drove him to Memphis, I think, to the Sun Studios. Thank you so much, as he just corrects me in my ear. That's what good producers do. That he would, Angie, the gentleman that would say, I caught him there. He would take
the
him
voice
to every
behind.
Gig.
Elvis has left the building.
What I'm amazed at, though, why didn't they just have a recording and hit play every time he finished a gig? He actually had someone.
He actually had, the guy's name was Al Strada, and he actually was on the road with Elvis. And literally, as he was saying that, Elvis was already in the car and out of the building. He really was, before the music would even stop. Where, of course, nowadays you go to a show, you've got the artists that go off stage, everyone's applauding for an encore, and they come back out. Not Elvis. Elvis never did an encore.
There's this amazing footage, I think it's from Vegas, where it was in a documentary I watched over the weekend, where he runs off stage, literally runs out the door and jumps into a waiting car, limo, jumps in the back. He's still sweating. He's still out of breath from singing and dancing. And yet he's off.
He's off.
He's away.
He is just like...
corralled out so quickly, and hence the need for this Elvis has left the building, because there was a need for that kind of management, wasn't there?
Because when they actually started saying that, it happened at the Louisiana Hayride, was the first time it was ever said. And it was because Elvis was one of the middle acts at the Hayride, and the fans would keep chanting after Elvis left the stage. And so the announcer would go over and say, Elvis has left the building, but we have coming up the other act, so the audience knew, okay, Elvis is gone, we're on to the next act. So that's kind of where the saying even got started. And that was early on in his career. Yes, that was back in 1954, 55, very early on. So going on with them saying it at the shows, it really was kind of, it became kind of like a trademark. It's like, Elvis has left the building, and now you can go on back to your everyday life.
Should we focus a little on his early career, that the, you know, 1955, as you say, 1956, because you can really separate his career, can't you, from his early days in the middle 50s to when he went into the army in 58, and then when he came back from being stationed in Germany, because his career under the guidance of Colonel Tom Parker took a trajectory that perhaps Elvis wouldn't have chosen. But let's talk about those early days and why he was so big back then.
It's because of the music, the sound. It was all about breaking barriers. It was all about, you know, changing what the norm was, basically, at the time. Elvis, and especially his manager, Colonel Parker, realized early on that the teens had a voice. This was really when music and everything was geared to the parents and not to the teens. And they were one of the first duos to realize that there is this teen market that has this voice. And so they were really focused on marketing to them. Now, of course, everything today is marketed towards kids, and the parents go along for the ride. But it was just, he was so different than what anyone had ever seen, even if it was simply the clothes he wore, the way he wore his hair, the way he moved on stage. When the first time he was on television, it was kind of like, if you watch those early TV shows, you're sitting through, you know, plate spinners and harmonica play, all of this entertainment. And then Elvis comes on screen and it's just like, what just happened?
I know. And you would have parents kind of jumping across lounge rooms trying to cover, you know, young women and young men's eyes so they couldn't see his gyrating hips on the television. I'll be interested to know whether or not you think that the next generation, there's a text here saying, I don't think Gen Z will think he is the king. You know, do you think he's cutting through, Angie, to that next generation?
You know, that's interesting, because I personally think so. Everyone is discovering Elvis in different ways now. Back in the 50s and 60s, or even when I discovered Elvis, I discovered it through my mom. But the kids nowadays are discovering Elvis in various ways. If they're hearing a song on a commercial, or they're seeing a reference in a television show, or even with the new Baz Luhrmann movie that's coming out this summer, Elvis, it's just keeping Elvis relevant is what our job is. And I think Elvis is almost as relevant today as he was, you know, when he first got started in the 50s. At Graceland, over 35% of our visitors fall under the age of 40. And we're finding that our fan base is actually gearing younger every year, which is, it's a very interesting, because he's gone from being, you know, the Elvis of the 50s and 60s and 70s to this pop culture icon, everyone knows who Elvis is, level. And there's so many of today's artists that are influenced by that and the music. And so he's still very relative. I like to say my daughter, she was a huge One Direction fan, well, still is. And she was fascinated when she heard Harry Styles talking about how Elvis had influenced him. And in fact, the very first song he knew was the words to an Elvis song. And he dressed up as Elvis at some, you know, talent show or something. And it just, Elvis's influence is so subtle, but it's still there.
Harry Styles definitely got Elvis vibes. I mean, I was watching
he really
him
does.
On the screen the other night, and he was in a head-to-toe black suit. sequin jumpsuit and doing, you know, all of the moves. And he really does look like him. Angie Marchese is with you, the Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at the Elvis Presley Enterprises. But speaking of fans, let's bring Wayne Hawthorne into this conversation. He's the president of the Elvis Fan Club of Victoria. Wayne, is Elvis cutting through to this day as much as he was a few decades ago, do you think?
Not as much as previously. I mean, I've run this club since 1971, and it's a different scene. You're right, a hell of a lot of young people go along to Graceland and whatever and love it, but not to the extent that it was, especially 50s, 60s, 70s, when Elvis was alive, and for 20 years afterwards, maybe 30 years afterwards. But the younger brigade are, regarding membership and regarding product and whatever, I'm sorry, dropping off.
No, you're right. I mean, I guess it does remain to be seen into the future. And Angie mentioned the Baz Luhrmann film that's being released in the middle of this year. But Wayne, talking about whether Elvis still cuts through, he certainly did when you were young. You saw Elvis live in concert. When and where was that?
That was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, November 28, 76.
Can you explain how he captured the audience? Because we hear a lot about his appeal on stage and how it seems like he was singing to you if you're in the audience, even though it was a stadium or a concert or a Las Vegas venue. But he had something that captured and compelled the audience to keep watching and go along on this journey with him on the stage. Talk us through that what you remember about it.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the first thing, basically, was when Elvis came out. I mean, we had front row seats in a box stage height at the front of the stage. His piercing blue eyes, I mean, it was absolutely magnificent. And we had other friends there in Frisco up in the bleachers, and they felt the same way, that they really felt when Elvis came out, he was in brilliant form that night, a beaming smile. He was fantastic, but it's almost as though everybody said they felt as though he was singing directly to them.
Gosh, what a skill. One person that we haven't discussed today is Elvis's manager, Tom Parker. Now, he is a little controversial, and we'll get into that with Angie in just a moment. But is it true, Wayne, that you met Tom Parker?
Met him twice, once at the concert. We were sitting there and Colonel Parker walked by, and next minute one of the boys has come and said, "Would you like to meet Colonel Parker?" Yes. So we spoke for about 15 to 20 minutes. Found him to be a wonderful, honest man. I've got a hell of a lot of time for him. Met him again a few years later in Vegas. He was interested. What he wanted to know was, where'd you get that T-shirt?
Because he loved his merchandise.
But it was our fan club T-shirt, and he turned around, and once he found that out, he said, "Do what you want to do." He said, "You guys do so much for Elvis without being paid for it." He said, "You got my blessing. That's a wonderful T-shirt, keep on keeping on." And then we went into discussions about other things, which he was very open about. Is Elvis ever going to come to Australia? No. Straight out. He said, not enough money in Australia. If he goes to any place in that part of the world, it'll be Japan. But we are planning in 1978 to take a tour to Germany. He said, Elvis wants to go back there. He had a wonderful time there, and he'd like to
go back, because that's where he was stationed when he was in the US Army and did his service in the late 50s.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and of course that never eventuated because Elvis passed away, unfortunately.
Do you remember how you heard?
Oh, yeah. I was driving to work and was on the radio. And immediately did a U-turn, went back, called work, which was at Foreign Affairs, and said, won't be in today. And by the time I got home, oh, my God, you know, the phone was ringing from... because I was in the telephone book in those days, so every TV station, radio station, oh, my God, newspapers, it was very hectic.
Because you were president of the Elvis fan club back then.
That's right.
When
That's
Elvis
right.
died. And you still are. For how
and
many years
am,
did you say?
Yeah.
Over 50 years.
Yeah, 1971 I took it over. People
still
say, why do you still do
sense.
It? I love doing
how,
it.
How many Elvis albums and the like do you have? Or how much paraphernalia do
right.
you have?
Okay, with Elvis records, 45, 78s, LPs, whatever, way over 1,000, because I collect them from all around the world, and I've travelled all around the world many times, and you pick them up in Peru, Bolivia, Guatemala, El Salvador, doesn't matter where you go, in those days, I'm talking about the day's final, you pick them up everywhere, Korea,
gosh.
Taiwan.
Yeah, but you've got mainly original stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You mean with memorabilia?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm into the original stuff from EPE in the 50s.
Well, you're going to be excited about some of the original pieces that are going to be at the exhibition on the that opens this weekend. And I dare say you'll be legging it down to Bendigo to see it, Wayne. Wayne, do you have a... I know it would be very hard. It'd be like picking one of your favourite children, but do you have a favourite song?
I've been asked that a million times, and there are so many songs I could name, but I always say too much because Elvis was too much.
Oh, beautiful. Well, Wayne, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for being the president of the Elvis Fan Club of Victoria for so long. It's really important to have people have those roles, and we know that it takes up a lot of time, so we really hope that you enjoy the exhibition in Bendigo. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
That's Wayne Hawthorne. He's the president of the Elvis Fan Club of Victoria. This song, Too Much, is his favourite. Now, this is one, Fiona Parker, that I actually didn't have in my list, and this is the thing. There are just so
many. The back
many.
Catalogue is incredible, isn't it?
Oh, it really
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. I have to share your honey too much. When I want some loving, you're gone. Don't you know you're treating your daddy wrong? And with you as well is Angie Marchese. She's the Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at the Elvis Presley Enterprises. We are talking Elvis today because the exhibition, Elvis Direct from Graceland.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby.
Funeral arrangements for rock singer Elvis Presley have not yet been announced. The entertainer died Tuesday in Memphis from what doctors call cardiac arrhythmia, irregular heartbeat. He is being mourned by millions around the world. Entertainer Sammy Davis Jr. was asked how he would rate Elvis on a scale of 1 to 10.
Well, he's got to be 11. I'm not saying that because of the tragedy of the moment, but because anybody in this business of ours that can become one of a kind... He's the one, the only, the original. Everybody else is an imitator. It came after him.
Elvis Presley, dead at the age of 42.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto.
And this text, when Heartbreak Hotel came on, I would run, grab a chair and put my ear to the radio. I was 15 and I was besotted by Elvis. I even knocked my mum over one time. That's from Annie. And Fiona Parker, you are in Bendigo as the host of the ABC Central Victoria Breakfast Program, but Bendigo now also the home of the Elvis exhibition that opens this Saturday.
That's right. And Angie Marchese is in the studio with me here in Bendigo. Bendigo, and some of the items that will be in Bendigo as part of the exhibition include the car from Blue Hawaii, which, if you remember that film, it was this little red car that, as I understand it, Elvis actually purchased himself in Europe and brought to Hawaii while they were filming the movie in order to just zip around the island in, and then they ended up using it in the film. It's so prominent in that film, having watched it again recently. And I just want to focus a little bit on Elvis's Hollywood movie career, because we mentioned that Colonel Tom Parker was a manager that did a lot to make money and signed a lot of contracts, or got Elvis to sign a lot of contracts that perhaps Elvis wouldn't have chosen himself. And hence we have the legacy of those Hollywood movies where he essentially played the same part with a pretty lady, sang some songs, which are the albums he released a lot in the 60s during that time. He did release a gospel album during that time, but most of the albums were the Hollywood film soundtracks. After starting his career in the late 50s with more dramatic roles like in King Creole and Jailhouse Rock, where he was wanting to be more a James Dean type actor, but then was pushed in this other direction when he got back from Germany.
Yeah, actually, you know, when Elvis met Colonel Tom, Colonel Tom told Elvis that, right now, son, you have $1 million worth of talent. Within a year, you'll have $1 million. And within 8 months, a Variety magazine had a headline in it that said Elvis, a millionaire in 1 year. So it took Colonel 8 months to come through to his promise. But Colonel Tom also was very quick on promoting Elvis to get him on TV, to get him his tryout for Paramount, to actually get him, you know, starring in roles, because he saw Elvis's talent as somebody that could cross from music to film to TV. And, you know, in the early years, the early first four movies before he was drafted were all more dramatic. And it was the career that Elvis wanted. And then Elvis goes into the Army, which ended up being very great for his career, because in the 50s, you had the teen audience and the parents were kind of not big Elvis fans. And then Elvis goes, gets drafted, could get out of the service if he wanted to, but he went in as a regular GI, just like everybody else did. And when he comes out after 2 years, now all of the parents that were anti-Elvis were all of a sudden on the Elvis bandwagon, because he was a good boy that did his service, served his country as every other kid did at the time. And so now he had a whole new fan base that he was trying to appeal to besides the teen audience. And when Elvis and Colonel got back to Hollywood to kick back up the Hollywood career, they start with G.I. Blues, obviously playing off of the fact Elvis just got out of the Army. And then they went to Wild in the Country and Flaming Star, which were still more dramatic roles before Blue Hawaii. Once Blue Hawaii hit and it became the cookie cutter for all the rest of Elvis's movies, but it basically was because it was a sure thing in Hollywood. It wasn't what Elvis wanted to do. It wasn't necessarily what Colonel wanted Elvis to do. In fact, the good thing about Colonel is he was a good manager, because he was always the bad guy. Because you never want your client to be the bad guy. It's always the manager. You want to be the one person that says no. But in 65, we have a letter in the collection that actually is to Hal Wallace, who was the producer of 9 of Elvis's films. And it's from Colonel. And Colonel's like, I can't take these scripts to my client. You know, where you would think that from the perspective of Colonel, he'll take anything. But he really was fighting for Elvis to get better scripts than what was being produced and what was being sent to him.
And yet we loved those cookie cutter. Like, they were, you were so right, Angie. They were all sort of the same, but we would watch them.
Everyone did.
Oh, no, we never got sick of them. I mean, I can see them now as clear as day. Let's bring in Henry Wagons now, singer, songwriter, host of Tower of Song on Double J. When we talk about the influence of Elvis, Henry, you're also involved in this exhibition, and we know you've been to Graceland, but I started today's program by actually a quote of yours, and you've once written that Graceland is a powerful gateway into Elvis's life, but it's also a place to unlock and unravel your own relationship with your personal memories of his music, art, and performance. Elvis has had a huge impact on you, hasn't he?
Absolutely, and not just me. I think every single gregarious, egomaniacal, limb-flailing front person in the world. You know, I feel like Elvis was so amazing at being the singer-songwriter entertainer, you know, and he kind of pioneered it in a large way and has influenced so many generations.
Yeah.
And even I'm talking the deepest, darkest, most coolsy Melbourne City laneway artists who don't even think, they think they're too cool for Elvis, but they love Nick Cave or they love Iggy Pop and the Stooges, you know, but like Nick, there's no bigger Elvis devotee, perhaps besides the president of the Elvis fan club who you spoke to earlier. But, the, you know, Elvis, he dyes, Nick Cave dyes his hair black. He's got the gold sunglasses, you know, and he took his Elvis's legacy in another direction. And you know, but basically there are these little entertainment family trees that all trace themselves back to Elvis. Elvis obviously has his own influences too that he got, but Elvis was the start and the
what's amazing,
so many artists.
Though, when, and a part of this exhibition will show who was the real Elvis, like how much control did he have, yes, over his career and whatnot. And even though, Henry, you know, you believe that those that wear the outrageous sunglasses and jewellery and flail about on stage, but they're the ones that you think are actually hiding themselves the most. Do you think that Elvis was hiding himself from the world?
Well, there's a sense in which, sort of like the Tasmanian devil in amongst the whirlwind, behind those Hollywood movies that had such artifice, you wonder, you know, pierce through the entertainment shield. It's like, well, what's he actually like when he's on the couch? What's he like when he's at home? I feel like, say, if you were watching a 90s grunge band where the guy gets up in tracksuit pants and a ripped shirt, you actually know what he's like at home. You know, you know what he's like on the game. But there was such, Elvis was like a superhero, be it on the silver screen or on stage, and sort of Graceland gives you that window into who he is in his normal life. Yes, it is fairly gregarious, but you pierce the fourth wall, and that's why we're so lucky to
we do to keep have hearing Graceland. About that spiritual journey that Elvis fans go on when they go to Graceland or they go to Tupelo or they walk the streets of Memphis that Elvis walked. It's as close, right, as Elvis as any of us are ever going to get these days. Do you feel close to him even though you're never going to meet him or see him perform?
For sure. And Graceland totally filled in that picture for me. You know, from the dust, I didn't get very close to him through my mum's dusty VHS that I first discovered him through, sort of in concert. But when you actually walk Graceland and when you'll see these pieces at the Bendigo Gallery, there's something tangible and real, and there's a relationship. You know, it may be in your own head, but, you know, you do definitely feel closer to him being in the same room as his things and things that he loved, and you begin to impose what and think about what you love, and sort of compare yourself to Elvis and wonder what it's like to have a chat to him and live alongside him.
And you know, Henry, this is Angie from Graceland, and one of my favorite things that I always do is when I'm at the front door, I always explain that you're about to walk into Elvis's world and you're crossing through the same threshold that Elvis did in 1956, and that you're walking through the front door that Elvis greeted friends at and family, and he brought Lisa home from the hospital in. So this is really welcoming you into who he was as a person. And oh yes, we're going to show you some gold records and tell you all about his career, and you're going to see clips in that, but this is about Elvis at home and who he was off the stage, and how it's great when he would go down to the gate and interact with the fans at the gate and sign autographs and invite them to go to the movies with him. And, you know, he was just this lovable guy that never forgot where he came from, but ended up being this world icon that had this, I guess you can call it, it factor, because that's what everyone was so attracted to. You can't really name what it was, but how everyone was attracted to it for one reason or another.
And you mentioned Lisa as in Lisa Marie, and you work closely with Priscilla Presley as well at Graceland through Elvis Presley Archives. Tell us a bit more about what it's like working with them on the legacy of a man who they knew so well and loved so much.
It's so interesting because you can study and learn about Elvis's career, the facts and figures about him being the artist and the songs he recorded and what the movies made and that type of stuff. But being able to work closely with Priscilla Paula and with Lisa, you get to look at Elvis through their eyes, the Elvis that they knew, which was not the icon that we saw on stage in Vegas. It wasn't the jumpsuit guy that sang this song or did that. It was the dad, the husband, the friend. It was the confidant. And being able to get those stories and just look at him through these other glasses, it really gives me a full perspective of who he was as a person. You know, he iconically said in an interview that the image is one thing and the human being's another. And in Elvis's world, it truly was.
Mm. So what was he like? Just to answer Henry Wagon's question. What was he like? Tell me, please.
Tell you. He was a good old Southern boy who never forgot his upbringing, who literally all he wanted to do was take care of his parents who took care of him. He wanted to give them something. He was the friend you could always count on. He was the father to Lisa that everyone would want their father to be. He was the fun-loving guy. He was a practical joker, loved playing jokes, loved watching TV, but he also was what we interpret to as Graceland as an artist. He never thought himself better than anybody. He was always questioning why him, you know. So his record collection, we have over 5,000 records, and only 5% of it are records that he actually recorded. Everything else is what was popular at the time, what other artists were doing, because he was influenced by them. And he felt that there was enough room in this big picture for all types of artists. And so he was that guy that never, I don't want to say thought of himself as being it. He knew that there was more to it than just him, and that he was always very appreciative, said, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, you know, to whomever it was. So he was kind of the...
Yeah, it's that Southern politeness, isn't it, the yes, ma'am? And he never really lost that,
never,
did he?
At all, never. And it's funny because Lisa would talk about being backstage with Elvis, and she'd be like, I would be backstage hanging out with my dad, and then all of a sudden I'd be rushed to the front row, and then he would come out on stage, and it was like, Elvis, but backstage he was dad. You know, that was kind of like, so she would even get swept into the whole Elvis on stage icon, the music, the charisma of him, and backstage he was just dad.
It's so funny, like I feel like that makes sense that he was so humble because of that sort of intellectual distance he had and his sort of underplaying how much he deserved to be the king. You know, I feel like it opened him up to have fun with Graceland to some degree. Like the house, which is just so happy and positive, and he had unlimited resources relatively, and it makes you think, what would I do if I had unlimited resources?
Exactly.
Because it felt smaller than you expected, Henry, when you got there, didn't it? Like it felt more normal, so to speak.
It did. It had a sense of coziness about it. And
it's all the shag pile.
It's very homey. I mean, you can imagine Elvis sitting on the couch with his foot on the table, playing a guitar, or sitting at the table having dinner. You can imagine Elvis living in this space because it's not unattainable, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, and the fun thing about Elvis, about Graceland, about Elvis stories is there's stories about, you know, fans that would jump the fence. There were two girls one day that jumped the fence and were in the pool. And, you know, nowadays, if you did it, you'd be off and you'd be in jail. Elvis went out and told him to be careful and went back inside the house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Henry Wagons, just finally, there's a text here that says years ago, the small gallery at RMIT Story Hall had a small exhibition of Elvis memorabilia. It included his personal Bible. It had margin notes in his own handwriting. I was in tears when I saw it. I shall be heading to Bendigo for this ASAP. That's from Carol in Heidelberg. Was it an emotional experience for you? I know you've been to Graceland multiple times.
Twice.
But it would have, did you, I was getting teary even before listening to you, Angie, saying, this is the door where Elvis greeted his guests, his mates. You know, this is where he walked through every night when he finished work. It must have been emotional for you.
It's quite overwhelming. You know, I feel like it definitely, it was emotional in particular, like he's buried at Graceland. So when you get that sense of closure at the end, that's almost tragic. But as you walk through the house, I wasn't crying. I was smiling. I was grinning because you got the sense that this is the expression of an artist in full flight that knew how to have fun and surround himself with things that made him smile and happy. And that is contagious as you wander around. Yeah, you're sentimental about him roaming the halls and stuff, but it's also an incredibly happy place. I defy anyone to say that actually Graceland is the happiest place on earth.
I agree with you. I think it's the happiest place on earth.
Well, Angie Marchese's been working there for over 30 years now. Henry Wagon, super fan and musician involved in the Bendigo Art Gallery programming for the Elvis Direct from Graceland exhibition, which opens at Bendigo Art Gallery this Saturday. Thank you, Henry, for joining us this morning.
Absolute pleasure.
And one song that apparently has a little story behind it is this one.
Return the sender. I gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack. Bright and early next morning, he brought my letter back. She wrote upon it.
Jeff Jenkins, music journalist. Jeff, I don't know what the story is, but apparently you've got a little bit of intel behind this particular song.
Yeah, I love this song, Rochelle. And apparently many Elvis fans, and I'm sure a lot of Australians, would send Elvis letters, but they'd just make up the address just so the envelope would be returned and stamped, return to sender, address unknown. I love that.
That's so clever. I wonder how many times that happened. That's the best. Jeff, we've been talking about whether or not Elvis still cuts through now, whether the current generation, whether the generations coming through. You know, if I said to my 8-year-old, I'm talking Elvis today, would she turn to me and say, who? Like, how do we know whether or not this legacy and this fascination will continue?
Yeah, it's a good question. I loved Henry's description that Elvis was like a superhero, because he was. He changed the world. I do wonder, though, for kids today, whether they think music started maybe with the Beatles, and the Beatles' legacy has been preserved so well. And that's why I think something like this exhibition is so exciting, because it's, you know, it's as close as we're going to get to the real Elvis Presley. Because the great Elvis tragedy for us is that he never came to Australia, which is kind of crazy because he was so big here. And all the big acts came here at least once. I mean, we got to see the Beatles and ABBA and Led Zeppelin. Sinatra came a couple of times. But we never got to see Elvis, which is really sad.
Yeah, he never toured overseas. In fact, there was talk of it, I think, Angie, at one point, but then he ended up in a residency in Vegas, of course, and Vegas Elvis was born.
Yes, exactly. You know, Elvis always wanted to tour overseas because Elvis, you know, having been in Germany during the army, he fell in love with Germany and wanted to see his fans and connect with them. It just never really worked out. I mean, we do know that in the 60s, when Elvis couldn't make the tour to promote Tickle Me, his car came to Australia. The gold Cadillac did. It did a tour. Elvis was too busy making movies at the time. But yeah, I know Elvis had the desire to travel overseas and to tour to connect with his fans. And it's still quite ironic how many fans and fan clubs are around the world for someone who never actually performed in their home countries.
Isn't that incredible? Jeff Jenkins, a few texts along the lines of, you know, is it true that Elvis didn't actually write any of his songs? Many people saying that he didn't write his songs. Did that matter to a lot of fans? And is it uncommon to have that many hits and to maybe not write them?
Yeah, I don't think so. They were great pop songs. And great songwriters like Lieber and Stoller and Doc Pomus. Yeah, I don't think it matters at all. The fans didn't care. He's had 120 entries on the Australian singles chart. That is mind-blowing. 14 number one singles in Australia, the most by any male artist, second overall to the Beatles. And he spent a combined total of 61 weeks at number one in Australia. So since pop music started, Elvis has spent more than a year on top of the Australian charts.
And he's never even toured here. Isn't that amazing?
No. In 1957, though, I want to point out the great promoter, Lee Gordon, he did all the big shows back then. The story goes that he gave Elvis a wallaby. I don't know why that was the case.
He did.
But, and he announced the Elvis tour. But the tour didn't happen. I'm not sure what happened to the wallaby, but
Angie, do you know?
It went to the Memphis Zoo.
It went to the Memphis Zoo.
Yes, there you go, Jeff.
That's incredible. Who would have thought? I mean, what do you do with a wallaby? Carry-on's hard enough at the best of times. Lindsay's in Kensington. Lindsay, if you're quick, what did you want to say?
Yeah, I used to be in the fan club a long time ago, and I knew Wayne Hawthorne. Yeah, and went to Graceland on the second anniversary, so I just missed him by 2 years. But, yeah, it wasn't open then, it was all closed. But you could go on the grounds, but then that came later on where they opened the place up to everybody. But, yeah.
And was it emotional for you too, Lindsay? You know, Henry and those that have been there spoke about sort of how it felt to be at his home.
Yeah, just to be there and everything, you know, it was just, just unreal sort of thing. And no wonder he was friendly, because even the local people there, they just seemed to be laid back. How are you going, and what are you doing today? You know, real friendly kind of that sort of, you know, atmosphere.
Love it.
And there's actually a story, isn't there, Angie, about how Graceland ended up as a museum?
Yes. Yeah, so 5 years after Elvis's passing is when we first opened for tours. And the amazing thing is that then Priscilla, who was the driving force behind, you know, what to do with Graceland, and Jack Soden, our CEO, they were literally told, get in, get out. You have probably 2 or 3 years, then everyone who's wanted to see Graceland would have seen Graceland, and then you'll have money put away for Lisa to inherit, yada, yada, yada. Well, that was 40 years ago, and 23 million visitors later, we're still open for tours and still welcoming people from around the world, including over 20% of our visitors are international.
And I know we've only got a couple more minutes with you, but the fact that a lot of the stuff, as you called it, from Graceland, the artifacts from Elvis's life and Elvis's movie and career are coming to Bendigo, is so wonderful. What did you think when you heard a gallery in Australia wanted to hold an exclusive exhibition of Elvis's things direct from Graceland?
You know, we've had the opportunity to do these kind of exhibitions a few times. But Australia has always been one of the countries we've wanted to go to, because we knew that Elvis was such big here. And being able to work with the Bendigo Art Gallery to make this dream happen and to be able to bring Elvis and the items from Graceland here so that people of Australia can, I know it's not Elvis himself, but it's as close to Elvis as we can get, to be able to enjoy the exhibit, learn more about him, relive all of the memories.
See the jumpsuits. Elvis and Priscilla's wedding outfits will be there.
His first grade crayon box, the car from Blue Hawaii. I mean, everything that you're about to see at the museum. And I hope that it brings you that one step closer to people who will never have a chance to go to Graceland.
The leather jacket from the 68 comeback special. I think that's there as well.
If I can dream suit from the 68 comeback special. Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
So it's going to be amazing. And it's just such an honor to be able to bring Elvis and continue his legacy here in Australia.
It feels like they're a family that never threw anything out. I feel really glad now that I'm a hoarder myself, because there's all bits and pieces. There's, you know, things from his report cards, even grocery lists of things that I know that you've got in the archives. Mm-hmm. Angie, you have the most incredible job. You really do. And it's wonderful to know that those that start out in a gig and they think, can I get my dream job, that you've got that. Thank you so much for not only coming to Australia, but for coming to Bendigo and for spending an hour with us on the Conversation Hour. Enjoy the exhibition. I dare say there's a lot of excited Victorians that are looking forward to getting in and seeing Elvis direct from Graceland. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Angie Marchese, who is the Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at Elvis Presley Enterprises.
Well, Fiona Parker, given that you are in Bendigo as well, you are going to see some serious Elvis outfits over the next couple of weeks. So thank you so much.
We're going to see Cadillacs driving the streets of Bendigo. We've got rock and roll performances. Every venue in town's jumped on board. It's been so good to see. And also this last hour, Rochelle, has been such a marvellous rabbit hole to go down. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, enjoy it. Enjoy it, Bendigo.
What you doing?
left to know.
Don't you know?